It's time for her to keep her mouth shut, wrote a critic of her film's submission. Where reprimands fail, others turn to violence. Religious fanatics are trying to kill her for speaking her mind, just as they brutally murdered the film's director, Theo van Gogh, in 2004. Yet she has courageously defied their threats again and again. She refuses to be intimidated into silence or submission. Her name is Ayaan Hirsi Ali. Born to a Muslim family in Somalia, Ms. Hirsi Ali emigrated to the Netherlands in 1992 to escape an arranged marriage. In the Netherlands, she learned Dutch, worked as an interpreter for other Muslim women in abortion clinics and in shelters for battered women, and earned a master's degree in political science. From 2003 to 2006, she served as a member of the Dutch parliament. Her film Submission, made in 2004, depicts the plight of five Muslim women who, in Ms. Hirsi Ali's own words, have submitted themselves to God's will and who are continuing to pray under terrible circumstances as they try to elicit a response from God. I wanted to introduce a shift in the relationship between the individual and God, she explained, from total submission to one of dialogue. This is what provoked the murder of the film's director and death threats against Ms. Hirsi Ali. She has written two books, The Caged Virgin, published in English in 2006, a collection of essays on Islam and women, the rights of the individual, the roots of fanaticism, and Western policies toward Islamic countries and immigrant communities, and a memoir, Infidel, published in 2007. She has received numerous prizes and awards for her work, and she was named one of the 100 most influential persons of the world by Time Magazine in 2005. She is now a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. Those are the facts of Ms. Hirsi Ali's biography, but how does one locate her and her ideas intellectually? Timothy Garton Ash, a professor of European Studies at Oxford University, has described her as a spokeswoman for the fundamental liberal values of the Enlightenment. At liberalism's core is the notion that we should strive to maximize individual liberty, so long as liberty is not used to harm others. Closely related is the idea that you are the best judge of your own interests. These were once deemed radical and subversive ideas, especially for women, and in some places in the world, they still are. Central to the Enlightenment was the kindred notion that individuals should think for themselves, exercise their own reason, rather than take tradition or authority, whether it be religious or political, for granted. As the German philosopher Immanuel Kant put it, have the courage to use your own understanding. That is the motto of the Enlightenment. Ms. Hirsi Ali's work reflects a fierce commitment to these values. She vigorously champions individual autonomy and self-determination, especially for women, over submission and paternalism. Individualism over the constraints of group, family, and community. Critical reason over absolutist attitudes toward the Quran and the infallibility of the Prophet Muhammad. And a sexual morality in which men, women, and homosexuals are treated as equals over gender and other social hierarchies. She finds inspiration in the work of the philosopher Karl Popper, from whom she takes the idea of the open society and the need to defend it from its enemies. And John Stuart Mill, the British philosopher celebrated for his defense of democracy, individual liberty, and women's rights, from whom she derives the notion of self-development. Mill thought the good life was one where you have gone out into the world to build the best self you can, traveled where you wanted, and seen what you could, and said what you had to. In keeping with this notion, he challenged what he called the Calvinistic theory that man needs no capacity but that of surrendering himself to the will of God. Mill argued that God could not intend human beings to be thus cramped and dwarfed, but rather gave all human faculties that they might be cultivated and unfolded. In a similar way, Ms. Hirsi Ali criticizes those who would invoke the Quran to stunt the self-development of Muslim women. But if Ms. Hirsi Ali is in some ways deeply inspired by classical liberalism, her feminist convictions take her beyond one of its chief limitations. Classical liberals feared an overbearing state as the principal threat to individual freedom, and they typically sought to preserve freedom by establishing a private sphere shielded from state power. This realm of private relationships included the market, family life, and, once church and state were separated, religion. Of course, the problem with this solution, as some liberals came to realize, is that state power is not the only threat to individual liberty. Market relations are themselves power relations. This is nowhere more apparent than in the labor market, where the threat of being fired is a powerful incentive for workers to submit to employers. Under these conditions, state intervention in market relations to prohibit child labor, for instance, or to set a minimum wage may be necessary to protect individual liberty. Feminists have drawn similar conclusions about private relations in the home and family. As Ms. Hersey-Avin is keenly aware and points out in her work, these too may be power relations, which, if not exposed and challenged, can limit the freedom and stunt the self-development of women. When these power relations are legitimized on religious grounds, she does not hesitate to criticize the religion. This aspect of her work locates her within a broader tradition of feminist religious criticism, shared by Mary Daly, the late Christian theologian who criticized the church for systematically oppressing women, and Nofrat Frenkel of Women of the Wall, arrested last November for the alleged crime, quote unquote, of carrying a Torah and wearing a prayer shawl at the Western Wall in Jerusalem. Ms. Hersey-Avin criticizes those who would defend, on multicultural grounds, private power relations within the home, family, and religion. Now, to be sure, cultural pluralism is itself a liberal value. It was John Stuart Mill who wrote, "As it is useful that while mankind are imperfect, there should be different opinions, so is it that there should be different experiments of living." But Mill was careful to qualify that claim by adding, "short of injury to others." Just as a laissez-faire market policy can permit private power to operate untrammeled, so too can a laissez-faire cultural policy. This does not mean, in my view, that we should reject multiculturalism in favor of unabashed assimilationism. But Ms. Hersey-Avin is undoubtedly right that cultural and religious freedom must mean not only freedom for the community of the faithful, but also freedom from it. Some have described Ms. Hersey-Avin as virulently hostile to Islam. Perhaps the best response can be found in her book, The Caged Virgin, where she writes, "Criticism of Islam does not mean that the faithful reject it, but it does mean that the faithful examine particular ideas and teaching that, when applied in real life, lead to brutal behavior with unacceptable consequences." In response to concerns that her criticism plays into the hands of Islamophobes, she argues that liberals, by the same logic, would refrain from criticizing the abuses at Guantanamo Bay for fear of playing into the hands of terrorists. In response to concerns that she singles out Islam for criticism while ignoring Christianity and Judaism, she replies, "When Jews and Christians discovered the power of words and images, they used them to shine a light onto their belief and culture, to find inconsistencies, to stop harmful practices, and to promote merciful, humane ones. The same must happen in Islam. The people who truly love the beauty of their faith must act to stamp out the ugliness." In my view, some of Ms. Hersey-Avin's remarks about Islam are too sweeping and too homogenizing. In last week's conviction of Scott Roeder for murdering abortion doctor George Tiller, and Israel's recent arrest of a radical West Bank settler rabbi for alleged complicity in the burning of a Palestinian mosque, remind us that the process of self-criticism in Christianity and Judaism is ongoing. Islam is by no means alone in its need for self-reflection. But Ms. Hersey-Avin's central claims seem to me important and indisputable. No cultural or religious tradition should be exempt from criticism. And people must have the chance to criticize freely and openly without fear of reprisal. It is not just the rights of women from Muslim families that she's fighting for. It is a fundamental human right for us all. Please join me in welcoming Ayaan Hersey-Avin.
Akbar!
Allahu Akbar!
Allahu Akbar means God is great. I'm not going to say God is great. I'm going to start by apologizing for the fact that you all had to face security measures that took us from starting this lecture 1 hour ago. We should have all started at 7:30. It's now 8:30. And I apologize, not because it's my fault, but because I know what it means to wait. Also what it means to be suspected of being a potential terrorist. Thank you, Professor Goldberg, for the kind introduction. I am very pleased to be here tonight to discuss women's rights and feminism in today's world. I'm only sorry that I will not be able to stay tonight and this weekend for the big hockey game. But I'll root for the Badgers. I've actually never been to a hockey game before in the United States, but in Nairobi once I went and we used the sticks to hit one another. And this is my first time in Madison. So I especially thank you all for welcoming me. Some people find my views controversial. They argue that I should be silenced. And I applaud the Wisconsin Union Directorate's commitment to free speech. And thank you warmly for giving me a platform. Let me introduce myself and give you a little background on how I came to be involved with the issues of women and Islam. And I will do this only for those of you who have not heard of me. And if you have and you're very annoyed, please bear with me. I was born in November in 1969 in Mogadishu, Somalia. My mother, the second wife of my father, bore him 8 children, and I belong to the 3 who survived. My sister, however, was 1.5 years younger than I am. My brother, Mahat, was 1 year older than me. When I was still just a baby, my father was thrown into jail because he opposed the president of Somalia, a dictator, Mohamed Siad Barre. Mohamed Siad Barre was a man and a junior member of the Somali army who had seized power 23 days before I was born. Years later, my father managed to escape prison and fled to Ethiopia, together with former politicians, to form the Somali Salvation Democratic Party, or Front. In 1977, or thereabouts, I was never good with dates, Somalis are not good with that, Mahat, Hawaya, and I snuck out of Mogadishu with my mother and fled to Saudi Arabia. My maternal grandmother joined us later. We lived for 1 year in Saudi Arabia before we were deported by the Saudi government because my father continued to be active in Somali politics. We moved to Ethiopia, where we lived for 1.5 years. In 1980, we moved to Kenya and settled in Nairobi, where I lived for the next 11 years. I was raised a Muslim, and as a teenager, I embraced Islam fervently. Like some of the members of the audience tonight, I also used to cry Allahu Akbar when I expected any kind of controversy. I was captivated by the way my teacher, the beautiful Sister Aziza, spoke about Islam and the beauty of chastity and purity, and was fascinated by the idea of dressing as she did in a hijab that covered her literally from head to toe. I eventually took to wearing the robe, to covering my hair, and I have to admit it felt powerful. At the time, I didn't know it then, I was living through a widespread revival of the concept of jihad and Islamic law. In Muslim countries, government officials were frequently corrupt, as they are now. Societies were collapsing, chaos was tearing countries apart. People were being persecuted or abandoned by their governments. And in reaction, we were turning to our tribes, our traditions, and the mosque became the center of opposition politics. I had wholeheartedly embraced Islam and was carried along in this current of fundamentalism. I strove every day to submit to the will of Allah, to the will of my teachers, the Imam, and my mother. And yet, there was this deep part of me that rebelled. And I had questions about things that I had no right to ask questions about. For instance, I remember the day while listening to yet another lecture on why women should cover themselves to avoid creating temptation for men, I asked the question, but what about men? Why don't they cover themselves? To stop me from getting tempted. In 1992, a distant cousin, Osman, came from Canada to look for his family and find a bride. Osman approached my father and asked him for one of his daughters. He said he was looking for a girl who was obedient, pious, and who would bear him 6 sons. And my father thought that I fit those criteria. Despite my protestations, my father agreed to give me away. I did not attend the marriage ceremony, but my presence was not required. The wedding party was scheduled to take place in Canada, where Osman's family lived, and where I was to make my new home as his wife. Osman went back to Canada after the ceremony, and I was to join him there as soon as my immigration papers were cleared. But at that time, the Canadian embassy was overcrowded with Somalis trying to have their families reunited with them. Another distant uncle, Mursal in Germany, offered to help. He sent me a visa and promised me to help for the union with my husband in Canada. My father was delighted and sent me off to Germany. Once again, I found myself struggling with submission versus my desire to live my life. Sister Aziza used to speak often of the two little angels who sat on our shoulders. The one on the right would recall every consideration, every deed that was right. The one on the left would recall all your sinful thoughts and action. Faced with the prospect of a life married to a man I didn't know and did not love, I found myself rejecting and I found myself disobeying. And in the end, the voice of sin won. I arrived safely in Germany, but instead of taking a flight to Toronto, I took a train to Amsterdam. I applied for asylum in Holland and was granted refugee status and later citizenship. I learned Dutch and worked as an interpreter for Somalis, mostly in different women in different situations, including in abortion clinics and women's shelters. After I was admitted to the University of Leiden in the Netherlands, I truly came to appreciate the privilege of an education in critical thought. After graduation, I was given a job at a think tank working for the Dutch Labour Party. There, I was asked to conduct research on the integration and assimilation of Muslims into Dutch society. I wrote articles on the subject, but especially on the plight of Muslim women, and was openly critical of Islam and the Islamic community. These articles were published from the fall of 2001 until the fall of 2002. And the gist of my work was that the basic principles of liberal democracies and the basic principles of Islam are incompatible. Therefore, immigrants have to make a choice. Because of my publications, my interviews, and my activism for Muslim women in Holland, my life was threatened and continues to be threatened. In 2002, in October, the threats had escalated to such a degree that I traveled in secret to Los Angeles to hide. During those weeks, I began to consider the possibility of leaving my work behind and starting off in the United States. 3 weeks later, after I went into hiding, the Deputy Prime Minister of Holland called and asked if I would return and become a member of Parliament. He assured me that I would be protected by the Dutch government as long as there is a danger to my life. Upon his request, and with his reassurance of my safety, I returned to Holland to continue my work and was elected to Parliament, where I served for 3 years. During that time, I focused my efforts on bringing to light the plight of Muslim women, and specifically in Holland. In August of 2004, I made a short film called Submission with Theo van Gogh, a Dutch filmmaker. Theo agreed with me on many issues, and he disagreed with me on others. He voted for me, even though I was a member of a party he derided. He regarded himself as a village idiot. But the country depended on him for provocation and excitement, because he provoked for the sake of provocation. In reality, he was a shrewd man with a great foresight. And when he made Submission, he said to me, "I live to provoke, and my work has been about provoking. But this film is not intended as such. It's a small gift to all Muslim women. It's the least I can do." In this film, we projected verses of the Quran onto women's bodies, verses which demand of women that men may beat them, whip them, rape them, and for such sins as disobedience and adultery. In response, Theo was slaughtered on a busy street in Amsterdam on the 2nd of November of the same year. His killer, Mohamed Bouyer, first shot him, then beheaded him, and finally left a long letter pledging to kill me pinned on his chest. All this because we dared to address the horrifying treatment of women, which is not only condoned, but also commanded by Islam. Submission was made to call attention to the suffering of Muslim women. The situation for immigrant Muslim women throughout Europe was and is dire. And although they live in a liberal Western democracy, many Muslim girls are removed from school soon after puberty and are forced to marry young men imported from their parents' native villages in remote areas of the Middle East, Asia, North Africa, and Turkey. Women are confined to small apartments in tall buildings. They are not allowed to leave their home, but only with their permission from their husbands. Muslim communities in Europe largely accept domestic violence as natural. There are honor killings, genital cutting, and a systematic abuse against Muslim girls and women on European soil. When I moved to the United States, I was shocked again that even the freest society in the world could not adequately protect Muslim women against these horrors committed in the name of their religion by their fathers, their brothers, their cousins, and their nephews. On my way to Madison, I learned of the Wisconsin idea. Shall we say, service begins at home. And the Wisconsin idea is that by educating Wisconsin's youth, the University of Wisconsin improves fast Wisconsin, and then the greater world will in turn benefit and follow Wisconsin's lead. This is an approach I applaud, the idea that charity begins at home, and have embraced in my own work to help protect and defend the rights of women in the West against militant Islam. All solutions begin with the step of exploring and understanding the problem. When Adlai Stevenson, the United Nations ambassador and Democratic presidential candidate, spoke here in 1952, Stevenson said that the Wisconsin idea necessitated the application of intelligence and reason to the problems of society. Stevenson's mandate to use intelligence and reason to create a better world could not be more true or more timely. We must use intelligence and reason to confront what I see as one of the world's greatest inequalities, the treatment of Muslim women. This inequality is not only a moral tragedy, but it's a threat to global peace. No culture, no religion, no idea has ever been so brutal to women as Islam. Feminists must rise to meet the crime against humanity posed by radical Islam to women. We must approach this attack on fundamental human dignity with intelligence and reason, because for us it's a matter of principle that women are free and equal, as it is for Islam too a matter of principle to oppress women. If we are silent, we are complicit. There is a parallel to be learned from Nazi Germany's experience during the Holocaust. Many ordinary Germans looked the other way when Jews were being rounded up and murdered. They abetted one of the greatest crimes of the 20th century through passivity, denial, and indifference. And then there were Hitler's willing executioners, and I borrow this term from the Canadian-American historian Daniel John Goldhagen. Some of the Nazis slaughtered Jews because they were part of a culture of anti-Semitism, but others went out of their way to be extra cruel. They made the process of torture, massacre, and starvation worse than it already was. The willing executioners toyed with Jews voluntarily and with unequaled malice and cruelty. Now, think of the Saudi Appeals Court, where authorities in 2007 sentenced a woman raped by seven men to 200 lashes of the whip after she appealed a sentence by a lower court that had judged that she should be flogged 100 times. It was a special kind of hatred the Nazis had for Jews, and Islam sanctions a special kind of hatred against women. All cultures and all religions have been unfair to women, I add. There were witch burnings in Europe and the United States. There are chilling verses regarding women in the Bible and the Talmud. But Islam's treatment of women is not something from the past. The Quran, unlike the Bible and unlike the Talmud, is the constitution of countries and communities today. The inhuman Islamic principles that govern women are so extraordinary, so systemic, and so difficult to change. But if the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a matter of principle, then we must examine the theory outlined by the Prophet Muhammad, a theory practiced by millions of people. If we take American values seriously, then we must break our silence if we are to defend the principle that women, just like men, have inalienable rights. Let's take a look at Islamic values. Let's scrutinize those values. Let's not shy away from subjecting Islamic doctrine to the critical thinking that all ideas in the West have been and are subjected to. The Muslim mind needs to be opened in the 21st century. Today, 1.57 billion people identify themselves as Muslim. And although they certainly have 1.57 billion different minds, there is such a thing as a dominant cultural trend. And the Muslim mind today is in the grip of Sharia, Islamic law, and jihad. What I want to make clear is that Islamic values are incompatible with American values. Note, Islamic values, Islamic theology, not Muslims. Muslims are diverse, they're individual human beings, they are the adherents, they can change their mind. I'm talking about the doctrine, the theology. And that doctrine, the theology, that political theory is incompatible with the American American theory and American creed. And that is a pretty strong statement to make. And I understand that I have to back that with arguments, and that my arguments should be strong enough to hold water. So let's take a number of core values. First, freedom. The Declaration of Independence says of freedom, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Contrast this definition of the individual's rights to freedom with Islam. The word Islam is often said to mean peace, derived from the word salam. In fact, the accurate definition of the word Islam is submission, specifically submission to the will of Allah, as related by Muhammad, the man who declared himself the last messenger of the one and only true God. This meaning is mainstream and is believed by all who identify themselves as Muslims. American values put the freedom and the responsibility of the individual at the center of this moral framework. In contrast, Islam demands total submission, the submission of will, total submission of self, and the abnegation of accountability. It is a clash of two cultures, one of freedom and responsibility versus one of obedience and lack of accountability. The relationship between men and women is equal according to American law and culture. Some of you would say, at least in theory. Here at Wisconsin, I am told that women were allowed to attend the university first during the time of the Civil War. Well, that's good for Wisconsin, for being ahead of other places in America and probably other places in the world. It took until 1920 for the phrase, all men are created equal, to include women at the polls. Now let's poll the audience. Put up your hand if you feel that it's justified to exclude women. Is anyone holding up their hand tonight? No. Does that mean zero people? That's pretty strong. Well, under Islam and Sharia, it is more than an opinion. It is law to exclude women from rights and freedoms enjoyed by men. Guardianship, marriage and divorce, testimony in court, dress, inheritance. In these issues, Islamic scripture is explicit that women are inferior. Allah's divine will is outlined in the Quran and in the teachings of Muhammad, which were recorded in the Hadith or Sunnah. The Quran is considered to be the true, undiluted word of God, revealed to Muhammad through the angel Jibril or Gabriel. While the Sunnah have often been debated by Islamic theologians, a consensus has been reached supporting the authority of a set of six volumes derived from them called Sahih Sitt. Six of them for the authentic six. The Quran and Sunnah form the basis of Islamic law and jurisprudence, or Sharia. In any country where Islamic law is implemented, if a woman is alone with a man who is not her family, she is punished by the state or by her guardians. For a married woman, this means stoning, For an unmarried girl, this means lashes with a whip, and it's not only women. If a man in these countries takes the law into his own hands and decides to carry out the punishment himself, most often he is not brought to trial. If he is tried and he can prove her transgression, then the man is absolved of any criminal responsibility. In the eyes of the state and his community, he will simply carry out his duty. These are the inequalities that are the consequences of these laws. An example from reality is Zohra M. Azad, Kabir Niyaz in Shahriya in Iran in 2007. They were lashed 99 times for illicit relations because they were found guilty of committing adultery. For homosexuals, there's no leeway. The punishment for engaging in homosexual activity under Islam is clearly stated. It's death. You are probably all familiar with the notorious statement from the Iranian president at Columbia University in New York asserting that there are no homosexuals in Iran. But what happens when Muslims follow these codes within the liberal secular democracies of the West who do not recognize Islam as the official state religion? In this case, these punishments are considered illegal and the perpetrator is therefore a criminal. However, the crime is often covered up by the family or the local Muslim community. Confronting the principles behind the crimes becomes nearly impossible, as any criticism of these principles is regarded as Islamophobia. The question that remains unasked is the following. Is Islam a religion? And this brings me to my next point. Many people offset Islam against Christianity. And to be sure, Islam has a religious dimension. But I think it's more accurate to offset Islam against other political theories, because Islam is a political theory. So is communism and its more benign sister ideology, socialism. Just like the political philosophy of national socialism. These are all sets of ideas on how society ought to function. The concept of America is also a political creed. It's a theory based on a society and how society should function. There is a defined relationship between the citizen and the state and between citizens. There's political law and a penal code. There's also family law that determines the relationship between men and women, derived from American culture, American values, American history, and American constitution. Similarly, Islam's political and social dimension provides rules for the relationship between the state and her subjects, and the relationship between men and women, and the punishment of those who break the law. The American creed and the Islamic creed are two competing ideas. They are as different as day and night. When I take a critical look at Christianity, as it is today, I find a rich evolution in Christian doctrine and how it's practiced. A similar study of Islam yields the shocking outcome that very little has changed in Islamic scripture and jurisprudence. The Quran is still the centerpiece of Islam. This book is conceptually poor, with a lack of human understanding. There is a focus on the vices and the negative adages of humanity and no place for the innovative, creative side of man, let alone women. The ideas, thoughts, and expressions of individuals are silenced and narrowed to what the Prophet Muhammad deemed to be moral. Everything outside of his moral framework is condemned. Now, ladies and gentlemen, just imagine contracting the imagination of 1.57 billion people to that idea of one single man. from the 7th century. There is nothing like a University of Wisconsin in the Arab Islamic world. Anyone who's honest will also admit that the early versions of the Old Testament and even parts of the New Testament are just as negative. That after many centuries of vigorous questioning and criticizing, Christianity shared its political dimension, and the separation of church and state is well established in the West. Christian theologians may have a political opinion, but there is nothing like what, but that is nothing like what Sharia is in Islam. There is secular law here that protects the freedom of believers to worship and unbelievers to have no faith. We have no such secular law where I come from. In the Middle Ages and beyond, people used to talk about vice. Islam is vice-focused. The teachings of Muhammad or the Hadith became the place to find a license to freeze into law the unusual and cruel punishments of medieval and pre-medieval times. When you read Christian doctrine, you see the same struggle in dealing with issues like alcohol, drugs, sex, and other urges to break the Ten Commandments. Western theologians and Western secular philosophers have thought about a system of rewards and punishments and debated that for centuries, for those who uphold the law and those who break it. The Bible may say the wages of sin is death. If there are Christians who want to kill, and there are some such Christians, they are stopped by other Christians, and if they are not stopped by other Christians, they're stopped by the rule of law. They are condemned by their fellow believers who have developed an alternative Christian theology. In Islam, those Muslims who engage in violence may sometimes be condemned by fellow Muslims, but they have not succeeded in developing an alternative theology because of the read-only lock on the Quran and Hadith. In Islamic countries, there is no rule of law and no separation of the realm of politics from that of Allah. Islam reassures women and other oppressed groups to persevere, for Allah will set things right in the hereafter. In fact, the Muslim is so focused on the hereafter that life on earth now has been declared only a transit lounge to a life after death. Now we know from history that any creed that systematically demands that you invest in the hereafter becomes a cult of death. The Islamic rule book mandates that you can't make a mistake. In contrast, the Enlightenment, which brought us the American Creed and the constitution of many European countries, honors life. It is not about honor after death or honor in the hereafter, but honor an individual life right now, right here. Can Islam be reformed? Is a question we will hear perhaps more than any other question this century. But if you cannot voice or even consider criticism of Islam, then you will never see what is wrong. You cannot solve a problem unless you identify its source. If we cannot look at the roots of what is wrong with Islam today, then in a very real sense, Islam cannot be reformed. So what should we do? We should start by viewing Islam as just another political creed. We are used to many political ideas. We debate the merits of socialism and the demerits of communism. We understand the political implications of fascism and Nazism. We live every day with the fruits of the American theory put into practice, and it's not perfect, but at least those of us who are lucky enough to live in America, we can pluck those fruits. We know that in the years during and between the great wars of the 20th century, there were Italian men and women who were good people. There were German men and women who were great folks. but they allowed themselves to be persuaded by the bad ideas of their time. When a large enough group of people believe in a bad idea, they are likely to carry that idea to its logical, to explore ideas and discriminate the good ones from the bad ones. We must examine them deeply. That is what it means to debate. Western enlightenment is all about scrutinizing religion and secular ideas. And all of that scrutiny, of course, leads some people to get offended. That's what we call a controversy. But ultimately, it is enriching, because you get a vision of the consequence of an idea, whether it's a good one or a bad one. Islam is exempted from this scrutiny. For instance, by feminists. Feminists attack the idea of the female as homemaker and mother and entertainer. They fought for the rights of women to go to school, participate in higher education, to vote, and also participate in public affairs. Feminists continue to do so to this day, attacking the glass ceiling. To me, it seems as if they only do it for white women. And they criticize only the bad ideas of a white man. Is this what has become a Western feminism? It set out as a universal movement to defend the rights of all women. But by abstaining from condemning the terrible principles held by men of color, that is, for instance, the religion of men outside the West and their cultures, Western feminism has become a force that protects only white women. Take the plight of Muslim women living here in the United States. Please, put up your hand if you have heard of the story of Amina and Sahra in Texas. 1, 2, 3, 4. 5, 6. I was told that there are about 1,300 people here. Well, Amina and Sahra were killed by their Egyptian father in Texas in 2007. Because he discovered they were dating American boys. They were respectively 16 and 18 years old. They were bright, healthy, beautiful, average American teenagers. Or at least they thought they were. Imagine what the reaction from feminists would be if Amina and Sahra were called Mary and Ruth, and if their father was Christian. How about the Pakistani man in a suburb of Atlanta who admitted to strangling his 25-year-old daughter, Sandela, to death because she wanted to leave the husband he had arranged for her to marry in Pakistan? How about Rivka Barry, a 17-year-old who converted to Christianity and is now in hiding from her own parents because Islam dictates she's an apostate and must be killed? In America, not in Somalia, not in Afghanistan, not in Europe, here in the US. Why the silence? Why do we respect the atrocities of the Muslim man on the grounds of culture and religion when we condemn the religion and the culture of the Western man? And look at it with a magnifying glass for the last shred of oppression. So many feminist groups are up in arms today because of a pro-life Super Bowl ad. How trivial is that story compared to the women who are veiled, stoned, flogged, and killed and married against their will? If you really want to wind yourself up against injustice, look there. The murders of Amina and Sahra Said in Irving, Texas, were punishments for the girls' perceived infringement of a religious cultural order. Although that order is old and brutal and comes from far away, it can operate in Dallas or Atlanta or Chicago or maybe even right here in Madison as legally as anywhere. When well-meaning Westerners, eager to promote respect for minority religions and cultures, sweep practices like forced marriages and confinement under the carpet to stop society from stigmatizing Muslims, they deny countless Muslim women and girls their right to wrest their freedoms from their parents' culture and religion. then we, by being silent, become complicit. We fail to live up to the ideals and values of our democratic society. And they harm the same vulnerable minority whom we all seek to protect. I am living proof that Muslim women in the West can benefit from turning away from the principles in their faith that justify subordination and embracing those of liberty in their host cultures. But there is a high price for urging Muslims to examine their beliefs. I have received death threats for becoming an infidel and have lived in hiding since the murder of my colleague, Theo van Gogh. When we made that movie, I did not expect that advocating for the freedom of women oppressed in the name of Islam would lead to the murder of a human being, the murder of Theo. This is how dangerous the principle is. And this is why it is urgent and important to examine the basic tenets of Islam in the way we examine the basic tenets of all other ideas. So I invite all of you to join me and make it a matter of principle in 2010 that women deserve basic human dignity and every chance at equality. Please visit my foundation's website, theahafoundation.org. Don't forget the THE before AHA. And there you can find ways that you can contribute, and it's not only financial. You can find ways that you can keep contribute and join the movement to fight for the principle of freedom for all women and against the principles of oppression in the name of tribal culture, in the name of Islam, in the name of whatever argument. Thank you so much for your patience, and I look so forward to the question.